Hello, everyone, and welcome to Artifacts. I'm your host, Marissa Dickens, and today is a special episode. It's the 50th episode of Artifacts. I don't know how I've done 50.
That's great.
Thanks. So thank you to everyone who's been listening in since I started in 2020. This podcast has been just so much fun for me. For me, it's always been about the artist journey. And today's guest has been an incredible journey in the film industry. So today I am joined by makeup and special effects designer and puppeteer, Tony Gardner.
Hello, how are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is cool. And congratulations on 50 episodes. That's really awesome.
I know, I've just kind of been, you know, chugging along and I'm just like, oh wait, I'm at my 50th. So I feel like I should do a little mention and celebrate that. So thank you for helping me celebrate 50 episodes. Tony, you've done a lot of things. So I'm just going to name a couple. Your work can be seen in Zombieland, Hocus Pocus, Chucky, The Addams Family, Hairspray, Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa, The Geico Caveman, and with Daft Punk. How does it feel to have such a diverse body of work?
I really like diversity. I like keeping busy and I like trying different things and I like challenges. So it's been really fun doing things like outside of my comfort zone, like constantly. I kind of rise to the challenge.
The challenge. I love it. So you are also from Ohio. Shout out Midwest.
Yes. Yeah. Now where are you from?
I'm from Toledo.
Oh, okay. I'm from outside Cleveland. All right. Yeah. We were kind of in the boonies, you know, not too far from the cornfields way back when.
But what was your childhood growing up? What was that like for you?
Just like every Midwest cliche. I mean, it was, you know, we'd ride our bikes, we'd be gone all day and have to come home when the sun goes down and we'd get into trouble and do stupid stuff. And when I was, I think, 12, I think my parents got me a movie camera. I was already into like music and theater and magic tricks and puppeteering and just weird stuff. And then I realized with the movie camera, you could do more and you could control how it was presented. So like you could do a magic trick and have a box and, you know, you could stop the camera and fill it full of stuff. And then when you open it back up, you know, start the camera again and open the box up, it's like, oh my gosh, there's really something in there. So it started out really simple doing dumb camera tricks. And then I got into makeup effects and then storytelling. And then we were doing weird stop motion stuff with people on the street. So basically I was just a weird kid in the neighborhood that had friends that would make weird movies like every weekend. That's what we'd go and do, you know, up through high school. So we figured out you could make a actually make a living doing it, but not in Ohio.
Yeah. How did you come to that conclusion of like, oh, like this could be a career I could do? What was that? Or how did you find that out?
Kind of by accident. I mean, there was no career path in Ohio at all for anything like that other than theater or like broadcast journalism. Mm-hmm. So I went to Ohio University in Athens.
Bobcat.
I studied theater and I was trying to get into broadcast journalism, but it's like a tiered program, or it was back then, and you couldn't do it as a freshman. So I just took all these different classes, but they needed prosthetic makeup in the theater department for a couple of shows. And this guy, Fred Dewar, was a production designer. And he's like, you can use my oven at my house and you can make prosthetics and you can do all this stuff. And he really set me up with like a lab in the basement of this theater. And I just started making stuff and realized how much fun it was. And then I realized at the same time, my resources there were super limited, that I had sort of peaked my freshman year and there wasn't much more you could do than that. And then I decided I'm going to go to California and go to film school and figure out filmmaking. And I didn't care what capacity I got in as long as I was part of the creative process. And I applied to USC and that was the only school I applied to. Because George Lucas had gone there. It was just like so like narrow-minded, you know. Yeah. And they accepted me as a fine arts major because I had this weird portfolio of stuff, and they said you could reapply to the film school here. I started doing makeup effects for the film students and then went down this rabbit hole there. I used a paper at school to meet people in this industry. And then I got hired by one of them for a 4-week job opportunity, which was right at the start of the school year. And he said, it's only a 4-week job. You can, he's like, you are all over the place. You are into music and theater and makeup and art. And this would be 4 weeks in makeup effects. You could see how it works. And if you're interested, at least you'll know whether this is what you want to do or not. And the job was Michael Jackson's Thriller. And I started as a runner. I was the guy picking up supplies and sweeping the floor and taking out the trash and doing all that. And I started helping people and staying longer hours. I realized I couldn't do school at the same time. I dropped out of school. I was a drummer in the marching band, but I didn't tell the marching band. So I stayed in marching band. So I could still do music. And I made a deal. It all worked out. But then the 4 weeks turned into an offer to be on his crew. I dropped out of school. I got to be in the music video. I got to build a zombie on myself. I got to show up to set every day. I got to experience the whole thing. The director, John Landis, understood I was interested in film. And he's like, you want to see how we edit it? And took me one night in post and showed me how they were doing flatbed editing and stuff like that. And just the whole process of the people and the experience, I was like, it was 8 weeks and just sort of changed my life. I was like, this is what I want to do. And I don't care really what capacity I'm involved. I just want to be part of this creative environment. And then I ended up working for the makeup effects designer, Rick Baker, for 4 years. So my 4 weeks turned into 4 years, and I didn't look back really.
That is
So.
so crazy, the trajectory of, like, oh, I'm done with Ohio, I'm gonna just try it. And you were such had such a drive to, like, I'm going to the school, but then you're like, oh wait, I
Yeah.
need these other projects. So it's kind of a combination of kind of exploring on your own
Yeah,
all
and
the
trying to meet people and talk to people and find out what it was about. And that's what I looked at those student films as opportunities to learn, because you're on set all day and watching how things work. I was fascinated, But yeah, it's like take every opportunity you have and say yes and dive in, and you never know what happens.
Wow. And you played your own little zombie.
Yeah. And it's funny
And you had to
because
build it for yourself on yourself, which I think is interesting.
it was a really tight budget. We did a lot of generic zombie makeups for the dancers. A guy named Sean McNamara sculpted most of those. And then I got to do a lot of the zombie masks for all the crowd scenes. And I was doing the bladders for the transformation. And I was mixing and matching pieces from other masks to build new masks. And I started realizing I could do that, something like that with prosthetics on myself and make it so that it was easy to get in and out of. So I made this zombie that was sort of like a prosthetic face and a rigid back of a head. And I could put it on in like 20 minutes and blend it in because it was dead. It's not like smooth skin, And John Landis really liked the way it looked. So he's like, hey, can you be the first zombie out of the grave? Hey, can you be the one whose arm falls off? Hey, can you be in the dance number? I'm like, I can't dance. He's like, all you have to do is like slap your butt and look over your shoulder. It's just for a quick montage of faces. I would just want to use your face. I'm like, okay, I can do that. So I did that. And then I ended up in the house in the end when they're all coming at Ola Ray inside the house, which was fantastic. And then I got to go on set one day when we didn't have to be zombies and we were all in the theater scene watching the werewolf movie, just in the background behind Michael and Ola Ray. So I got to experience it from a lot of different directions, I want to say, and some days I was just showing up and delivering supplies for other makeup artists to paint dancers, but the masks worked almost every day, so I was always there. It was great, and I just soaked it all in, and then all of a sudden it was over, and I was like, what next? Rick Baker offered to, he's like, we'd love to have you on the next thing. Don't know when it'll be. You can hang out and work on your own stuff. My parents freaked out because, they're like, you dropped out of school to now do nothing, because it just came to a crashing end, obviously, once it wrapped. And it was about 3 months of nothing before things started back up. And then it was busy consistently after that. But, my mom's like, you're sitting in an empty warehouse by yourself doing nothing. You dropped out of school, you lost tuition, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you just have to believe in yourself.
That's
And
the risk you have to take, especially in the art and
yeah.
industry. It's like you're not gonna, like, the consistency of work is hard.
There is none ever.
Yeah, that's what I'm learning being in LA now. I'm like, oh yes.
Yeah. My youngest daughter decided to be a filmmaker, and I was like, did you not learn anything watching the ups and downs of the 20 some years of your life? Because it hasn't been constant for us. It's freelance art, and I equate it to friends that paint houses, because
Oh yeah.
it's really the same boat, It's kind of seasonal. People don't want to do stuff in the winter. They don't want to start a show before the end of the year when it's getting close, because nobody wants to pay you holiday pay and all that kind of stuff. And they just don't want to gear up a production office. And then sometimes one person wants a house painted, and sometimes three people need their houses painted. And sometimes nobody really cares. And there's no rhyme or reason. It's really about meeting people, making relationships, and reminding them that you're out there, because I've learned that this is like a really visual medium, and out of sight, out of mind. If they forget you exist and there's another shiny thing over there, it's like making sure you're staying connected to people. It's important.
I want to touch on obviously Hocus Pocus. Hocus Pocus is such an iconic film, and especially with the new one out. But, and especially too, as a dancer, creating special effects but with movement, because you worked with like Doug Jones as Billy, and it's like, how do you create something for
Yeah.
such a physical actor and for a physical character?
The cool part with Billy was that it was really all about movement. And Doug Jones was in these Mac Tonight commercials wearing this big moon head at the time. Tall, skinny guy with this, I'm sure, obviously heavy and blinding thing on his head, looking lively and energetic and sliding down banisters and playing the piano and looking super happy. And it's like, whoever that guy is in there is a genius, because he's really selling that this guy is happy. And I'm sure he personally isn't at all. And I was just like, his performance is amazing. So I went and hunted down the guy who had built the moon head. And he happened to have a head cast of Doug Jones in his backyard behind his garage. And I'm like, can I borrow that? He's like, oh, you can have it. So I started sculpting all the character designs on Doug, because I was just like obsessed with him. And then he was having interviews for the part. So it was just sort of like synchronicity, where it's like, I was saying, if you like these designs, the only face this will work on is Doug Jones, because he has specific skinny nose and a specific jawline. And this is all built on him. And it doesn't look bulky because he's so thin. So it's really important you get somebody like that. And then it turns out they got Doug. I was really excited to work with him, because it's kind of like you're collaborating to create a character. It's like we're creating the aesthetics, but we have to do it in a manner that works for him to be able to move. And then we also have to make it so that he can be expressive. And it's really important that with a character that doesn't get to talk until the very end, that he's free to use his body however he wants. So my whole thing was, let's do a body cast of Doug, and let's make a very thin, thin suit that gives him all the skin texture of a zombie. Because the wardrobe lady wanted to, Mary Vogt was a costume designer, and she wanted to have the elbows ripped open and the thighs ripped open and most of his legs showing and stuff like that. So we made something that he could slip in and out of really quickly for the body, so that we weren't wasting his time. Because the more time an actor spends in makeup, the less time they have on set, and the less energy they ultimately also have, So did the whole facial prosthetic as a one piece foam latex piece, and figured it would go on faster with two people. So Margaret Prentice and I did the prosthetic application, and as fast as we could, everything was pre-painted, put all that on. put the bodysuit on and then the wardrobe on. And then we didn't bother with the stitches until we had to, obviously. And the hair was a pre-styled wig and it just went on and glued around the edges. So we could get it on him pretty quickly. So he had tons of energy on set and it was really easy for him to move around. And the fact that it was spandex and it was really thin over all the joints meant that we weren't restricting his movement in any way. So he could do whatever he wanted. He uses his hands a lot as the characters. And I wanted to do like these translucent fingernails that looked dead. So I extended the length of his finger a bit so we could add this little bit of length and then this translucent fingernail and have it be intrinsic and hard and rigid so he could touch stuff and it wouldn't bend or anything. But it also added more length to his fingers. So even though we had to build out to build a glove surface, we were adding length to it. So everything still felt proportional. So it's really all about trying to figure out the aesthetics and then movement and then performance. And then we had to deal with the whole, this is a Disney movie and he's a Disney zombie and he's going to get his head chopped off and his fingers cut off, but make it cute because this is a Disney movie. So
Those
there were
things
like,
never like cute, but like head chopped off. Never like going.
And we built a cat and it was the same thing. They're like, all right, we're going to run it over with a truck and it's going to reinflate and blah, 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 but make it cute. So, I mean, if you watch stuff like that where it's reinflating, they even do like a cartoony sound effect to help sell the cute aspect instead of the pancaked, cat. But it was a there were a lot of parameters that came at us, and the fact that we were working with Doug is what really genuinely made the difference. And then Mary Boat gave him a costume with a lot of layers and soft fabrics that flowed so that like when he spun, the tail on his jacket lifted up and he had sort of an extension of his movement through the wardrobe, which was really cool. And I always saw him as sort of like a punk rock Ichabod Crane. Susie and the Banshees was kind of one of the inspirations as well, to be honest. His hair is kind of up and messed up because it's bedhead. He's been asleep for a couple hundred years, but he's Ichabod Crane, so all the long stuff's in a ponytail. So it's more period. So it kind of balances it out. But we could tease his hair out and make it so that when he turned his head really fast, the hair also had some follow through like the wardrobe did. So we're trying to keep him a very fluid, loose jointed character. And then you put that on Doug Jones and he sells every inch of it perfectly. He's just so good.
It's like a
But it's really
combination of,
collaboration.
yeah, I was gonna say costume, makeup, and an
Yeah.
actor. It's so iconic. Do you ever sketch out or draw what you're thinking this character should look like beforehand, and then you do it? Okay. Very cool.
Back in the day, there wasn't anything called Photoshop. So we were doing designs on with pencil, colored pencil and pen and stuff on paper. And we would take those and we would, fax them or color Xerox them and mail them to Disney or David Kirshner, the producer, and say, what do you think of this? And we started out very like sort of traditional, heavier zombie. And he got more and more like we started drawing his because we hadn't seen anything Mary had done. We started drawing his costume sort of faux military with like epaulets and stuff like that. And it was starting to look sort of like Michael Jackson. But it's like that was cool. It had a presence to it. And I think that was one of the last designs we did prior to getting into the sculpture. And that design was literally just pen. No, it was pencil on white paper. And that was it.
This is like a side note. I was looking at your IMDb to like research, and is it true that like the police have investigated you because of your work? They thought it was like actually like real.
Yeah, a couple times. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
That, which is a compliment in a weird way of like
Yeah,
how realistic your
it's
work is.
definitely, yeah, it's definitely a backwards compliment. When we did this movie, Three Kings, I think that was the worst one of all of them. We had to shoot a bullet through a body, and David O. Russell, the director, wanted to see the bullet traveling inside the body. And this is pre-CG. This is before. I mean, now they do that kind of stuff on the NCSI shows all the time. They used to call it the Three Kings shot on when they were doing all those medical shows, and now they whatever the medical show is, they use that word as the title of what their shot is. But basically, we built this big fake body, and we had a bullet on a track through a rod behind it, and it's standing up, and all the organs are in it, and there's no skin on it. The bullet tracks through, and all the organs are designed to burst and leak and stuff like that. So you actually see the pathway and the damage the bullet causes. And David kept asking me how I'm going to do it. And I'm like, I have no idea, but I'm going to figure it out. You know, we'll make it work. It became sort of like a running joke. And I was like, well, why don't we just get a cadaver and just like use a slow motion camera and shoot a real bullet? Because they had this book had come out where there's an apple and a bullet is being shot through it in slow motion. You see the side of the apple open and all that. I'm like, that's what you want. Why don't you just do that? And so that became like a joke, you know. Somehow that got misconstrued, and then the movie came out and people thought it was real.
Oh my
And we had the FBI investigate us, and the assumption was we had taken a homeless person off the streets in Arizona where we were filming and shot them up with a bullet and filmed it. And so the missing persons division got involved, and then we were like, no, we'd never do that with a, you know, a human being. And then the Mortuary Society of America assumed that we had done it with a cadaver, and they're like, that's, you know, blasphemy and blah blah blah. And I had a Warner Brothers asked me to write up a description of how I did it, what materials we used. And they're like, don't fax it, put it on your letterhead and sign it, and sign multiple copies, because people are jumping over the fence at Warner Brothers, finding our production office and trying to get the scoop on what happened in this movie. So I had to drive a stack of these down, and every time somebody came into their office or whatever, it was like no comment, and they would hand this thing out to them, and that was the end of it. But that was the funniest one to me, because it started as a joke. But there's other things that we did where, you know, I mean, even back on The Blob in 1988, my wife Cindy's in it as this girl that's melted to the floor in this theater by the blob's goo. We shot in an old theater downtown, and I parked in an alley next to the theater to unload my car. And I had her body, her dummy body, with a bag over the head because the face is all melted and stuff like that. And it was kind of wrapped up. And then, so basically, this car parks in an alley next to a closed down theater, and then pulls out a body and walks in the door of the theater that's closed. And all these people with windows over the alley saw it, and they all called the police. So I'm in the theater gluing these things from her face into the carpeting of the aisle down the rows of seats. And these boots stop in front of me, and somebody goes, Tony, somebody wants to talk to you. And I look up, and it's a police officer.
Oh my God.
And I had to show him what I was doing, and I had to explain it. And then there's other times where we built stuff, and then the footage hit the lab, and somebody in the lab called the police and thought that we had done something for real. And the director of that one had people come to his house and confiscate stuff that we'd given him so they could prove that it wasn't real. And yeah, there were a lot of those.
That's
So
so crazy. The magic of filmmaking and people, you know, that's a backwards compliment. It's like your work
it's
looks so
nice too that people care and are concerned that
good.
something might have happened to somebody, you know. So
Wow. Okay, I want to shift to Chucky because Chucky, your most recent. Well, first off, Chucky as a franchise, why do you think Chucky is still a fan favorite and why do you think it's endured for so many years?
I think honestly, because he has personality. It's like, why is Ryan Reynolds so popular when he's just digging on people all the time? And it's like Chucky and Freddy were the same thing, only meaner. But there was always the sarcastic attitude and a personality. And I think that that's what made those characters endearing in their own weird way, even though they were murderers, you know. Chucky, we didn't get involved until like 20 years into the franchise, and it's been going for 40. So we've been in for half of it at this point. in the beginning, we were trying to figure out as well. And it's like, it's really the personalities and then the relationships with Jennifer Tilly and Brad Dourif as the two doll characters. And then through the TV series, she's also in this weird meta universe. She's also Jennifer Tilly as Jennifer Tilly and all this stuff going on. But I think the characters, the personalities, and then the attitudes that they have and the relationships with each other, it's just been written right and presented right. And Dom, there's been one consistent voice through the whole thing. David Kirshner has been producing them, and Dom Mancini has been writing the characters. And they've got Brad Dourif consistently playing the character for 40 years. And I think that makes a huge difference. So when we were doing the first couple films, it was really just all about, a haunted house and a killer doll, and there wasn't much more than that. And then once we got into the TV series, it's like, this is really being written to showcase the personality, and the character gets to talk more, and there's more interaction. And we had a bit of that when we started with Seed of Chucky as well, but there was group dynamics, and they had a kid, and there was bickering and all this kind of stuff. So we were trying to give each one of those personalities. But once we got to the TV series, it was like, we really need to make sure we're performing a personality. We're not just acting along with this dialogue. We're not just having one line in a conversation and we're out. We're having a monologue. We're having a conversation that goes on for 5 minutes with somebody. And he has emotions and everything else. So to perform Chucky, as far as like movement goes and performance, there's seven people trying to operate a 3 foot tall puppet
Set why was seven people.
as one brain. One guy's doing just the eyebrows, one guy's doing the eyes looking around and the eye blinks. Another person is doing the mouth and the lip sync. Someone else is standing over the head, performing the head and sometimes moving the torso. Then another person is performing the arms. And based on the shot where the puppeteers have to be, sometimes it's two people performing the arms. And then a completely different person is performing the fingers. So if Chucky has to sneeze and then turn to the side and then reach for a tissue and pick it up and put it to his nose, it's like there's four people doing this in timing with a head. Then somebody else is doing an arm, and someone else has to move the fingers at the right point to open the hand to grab and then close and then pick up and not do it herky jerky and mechanical, but make it look like a fluid person who's also leaning when they do it. And if you do all that stuff right, nobody notices that there's a performance involved. They just buy that the thing is alive. But if you do it wrong, it looks horrible and it looks like, garbage. And you could say, well, it's a doll and dolls move weird. And that was kind of the out on, a lot of the walking stuff because it's a doll. But all the interaction and performing and even just like, I'm going to talk to you. And then I heard a noise over there. So I'm going to look first with my eyes, then turn my head, then I'm going to react, and then I'm going to grab my knife. It's like everybody's involved. And where do the green rods in the arms cross the body? And how do we move the puppeteer out of the way of the front of the doll so that we're not making this hell for the VFX department? And how do we also move where we're performing from so that we're not impacting lighting? So we have to coordinate
Like a
with,
choreographed dance, basically.
yeah, it
Many
really is. And
people.
it's funny you say that because there's like a director of the week, sort of. There's a director, new director every episode or every couple episodes. And one of them came in and he's like, I just want to come in and I want to watch you guys rehearse. I want to watch the dance and I want to figure out how to fit the camera into the dance. And I was like, oh my God, this guy totally gets what we're doing, which was great, because we'd put together this video that showed how it worked to show all the new directors so that they had a sense of, there wasn't just a doll to direct. There were seven people, and some of them are right behind it, and some are next to the camera on radios for the head. And there's another guy doing the mouth down the hall in front of a monitor. That's like you got to talk loud to all of us, and you have to include all of us in your direction because we're all a piece of whatever you say, even if you think that action is really simple, because nobody sits there like this and talks and doesn't move
Yeah.
anything while talking. It doesn't happen, you know? So it was fun to watch new directors come in
So
and
say it's
realize
quite
that.
interesting with their different backgrounds and
And realize I've got to talk to all these people. But by the end of it, they were believing that they were directing the doll because we were fluid. We worked with the same crew for four years.
yeah.
And they would start directing the doll and forget that we were there, which to us was like the ultimate compliment, you
Yeah.
know? It's like, okay, we're doing our job. They're talking to the doll. And even Don Mancini would do that at times. We're all on radios to each other, so we wouldn't break that. We would go, okay, Don wants XYZ. We always rehearsed stuff in advance. And it was really important that we rehearsed so that we walked in and we were doing what we needed to do. But for us, because there's so much movement involved, any scene where the doll had a lot of action, climbing across a roof or whatever, we asked that they storyboard it so we could see how they're visualizing, because everybody sees it different in their own mind. So we would get the storyboards and then we would rehearse in our puppeteer room. We had a little area with a green screen set up and all that. And we would actually shoot the shots in the storyboard and edit them together so we could go on set, especially with like the new directors, and say, this is the scene that you want. This is how we want to do it. This is how we've practiced it. Would you like us to change anything? We would do that ahead of time. And then we would bring that, you know, we would make whatever adjustments. And then when it was time to shoot, we would bring that back on set and we would just have that there as a reminder. It's like, this is how we shot it. And sometimes we would also shoot it wide and go, and this is where the puppeteers are, and make sure the camera department and everybody else was aware of what was coming so that we could all collaborate together instead of butt heads, basically.
Oh my gosh, that's like, because I always grew up with like the Muppets and Sesame Street and all that puppeteering. And it's like, oh, there's like one guy in Big Bird. But like to have seven people on a small doll is really like interesting to hear about. And then,
And
yeah.
it's small. It's small. And so people are on the floor, like on top of each
And
other
all the
going.
spaces. Wow.
And the first few films, it was all cable operated, so that the doll usually had all these cables coming out its butt, basically, and going through a hole in the floor to the puppeteers spread out somewhere else. And we gradually convinced them over time that it would be a better performance the closer we were to it, the more we had our hands on it, we could bring it to life with a lot more subtlety. And they embrace that for the TV series in particular. And you can really see the difference in the performance and the nuance of stuff. Even though it's a killer doll, it still has personality.
Chucky cracks me up. That's so
It's
funny.
funny because I never thought I'd be involved with it. And I remember when the first film came out, and I'm like, it's such a weird idea. Can't you just like hold its forehead and like kick it away? And that's the end of it. And then 20 years later, I'm in charge of it. And it's like, all right, how do I make this threatening?
Now being in like the film industry now with CGI, how has CGI helped your work? But is there still also a desire for practical effects still in the industry? What has been your perspective on that and your experience?
My perspective is that it comes and goes. It seems to like sort of cycle. Like, oh, we want to do it all practical. Where the wild things are, all practical. And then they're like, oh, well, the faces were too heavy and the mechanics didn't move great, so let's do the faces all digital. And by happenstance, they realized that it was a great merging of two worlds and it worked really well. So every once in a while, where somebody's thinks it has to be a certain way and they have to shift, I feel like something new gets learned, which is really cool. And then people take notice and then the cycle changes again. But I think people really appreciate, and I know the actors really appreciate something practical that is tangible that they can touch and react to on set. And especially if they have to talk to and like emote with it. But CG's definitely made it easier. There's so many films now where, like 20 years ago, we would have been making body suits, creature suits for all the creatures in it. And now all the creatures are digital, and maybe there's a face made that's mapped onto a body or something like that. But things like Chucky, where it's supposed to be a doll that reanimates, it's kind of like, well, that's definitely practical. But the studios tried several times, even back during the last couple of movies before the TV series, to do stuff digital. They're like, it'll be so much easier and less people on set and blah, blah, blah. And they did a couple shots with like a digital Chucky walking down the steps in Curse of Chucky. And I think two more in that one. And the fans went nuts and they're just like, this is horrible and it's
Fans
ruined
will
and blah, blah,
tell
blah.
you.
Yeah. And they were very vocal, and the studio listened. And then as time's gone on, we've been able to, push for the more hands-on puppeteering, and digital effects have been our greatest asset because we can be right behind it. And we can have green rods and we can do all this stuff that makes it more alive. And VFX is a great tool to get rid of us in the shot. It's just, it has to be planned for. If somebody else is moving in the shot, it should be a locked off shot. Or if the camera's going to move, it should be motion control so you can get your background plate. It's great when you can use both together and you can create something that seems real.
Oh, it's so fascinating. I love this whole other world because I'm like the dance world, but it's interesting to hear that too. Oh.
It's funny though, because every time we go to, production goes to hire somebody to put in a suit, like we did this film, Robot and Frank, and they're like, we're hiring an actor to play the robot. And I'm like, well, you need a dancer. You need somebody who knows where their center of gravity is, who can shift it based on what they're doing, and also be able to move in a manner that can read through the robot suit. So you're getting what you want on screen versus what the actor thinks they're presenting to you through the suit. And dancers nail it because they've worn weird costumes and everything else. Rachel Ma, this ballerina from New York, who we didn't even build the suit on, and we cast based on her size, the size of the original actress. And Rachel was a perfect fit, but a brilliant dancer. And she brought so much creative movement and life to this faceless robot character, which was fantastic, but we always, even like for aliens and stuff, it's like, get somebody who knows dance, get somebody who knows movement, who knows how to work in front of the camera, and isn't claustrophobic and isn't afraid of wearing stuff, is comfortable doing it. In Hocus Pocus, there's a couple of scenes where Billy Butcherson loses his head, and they wanted to hire a stunt person to be like, he stumbles around. I'm like, you need a dancer. It needs to be somebody who knows how to move and exaggerate, because we're going to put a shorter person who's 5'2". We hired a dancer named Karen Malkus. Karen's 5'2". Doug Jones is 6'2". So that gave us some space for the zombie head, So Karen's head ends in the next stump, and her eyes are like right here. And she's looking through this bow that's part of his wardrobe, that's gauze that she can see through. She's wearing a skull cap with a little neck stump on top of her head, and then these built-up shoulders. So her arms are coming into the sleeves well below where the sleeve bottom would really start. And we've got bigger gloved hands on her. We've built rods off of her calves that go up higher to have false kneecaps at the right height to match Doug, because we put Karen on 3-inch lifts inside her shoes to get her height up. So there's all this stuff that a stunt performer isn't necessarily going to go, sure, I can do that. Whereas a dancer's like, yeah, I've danced in heels and done this, worn weird headdresses, and I'm totally comfortable. Oh, and I'm basically blind, and then I have to stumble around and find my head and put it on. Karen's like, yeah, count me in. And then there were scenes that would be what you would technically use a stunt person for, like Karen standing there and Bette Midler flies towards her and literally kicks the dummy head, which was on magnets, off of her
Oh,
next stump. And she's got to stand there pretty much blind. And Bette Midler is like, Yahoo, wire people, don't lower me too much because I'm going for it. I'm going to kick this dummy head. And Karen's, all the stunt people are like, this girl's got it. She's nailed the character and she's totally knows what she's doing, so we're not going to replace her for this one shot. And Karen did it, and they got it. I swear to God, it was the first take. is the
Wow.
best punt from a broomstick by a lead actress off of a dancer ever seen.
I'm telling you, dancers have worn everything, have been in everything,
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
we know our body in space. So that makes total sense.
Yeah.
It makes total sense. All your experiences, what is the best advice you've received and the best advice you would give?
Best,
Take your
What
time.
I thought was the best advice when I was starting was actually the worst advice somebody gave me, ultimately.
Ooh.
They told me, I was showing them pictures of different things that I had done. This was a guy who owned a makeup studio. He's since retired. And he's like, okay, you can paint and you can sculpt and you can punch hair. He's like, pick one thing and do it really well. And that will guarantee that you have consistency of work. And I understood where he was coming from. And I'm like, that's great. But the fact that I could do all of it meant I could do all of it myself and I wasn't dependent on other people. And I could take a job like the half corpse from Return of the Living Dead and when I was 21 and do the whole thing. Another guy helped me with the mechanics and somebody else helped me with molds just because I only had 2 weeks to build all of do all the molds. But a legit mechanic came in and did finger joints for me. But my best advice to share to me is say yes to everything. Just lean in to figure it out. Say, sure, I can do that. And if you don't know that, pick up the phone and call people that do. Now you can go on YouTube and watch tutorials. Reach out to people and ask for help. People love to help other people, believe it or not. And just believe in yourself. But ultimately, it's like the Jim Carrey movie, Yes Man, just say yes.
Oh, I
I had
like
a friend who was hired for a zombie movie, and he was a preppy with straight teeth, and he played a punk rocker named Scuzz. And I was a student at USC, and I just dropped out. So I made him an upper dental veneer, and it was to make his teeth look rotten, and I gave him a metal tooth, and he wore that to a cast read through, and the director said, "That's amazing. Who's your dentist friend? Maybe they could do some teeth for one of the other characters." And my friend did not tell the director I was 21. He set up a meeting at the director's house with all of us, and I came to the door, and the director was Dan O'Bannon, who had written Alien. So I was completely, excited to meet him because that was one of my favorite movies. So I'm just standing at the door, like this, and he's looking past me like I drove somebody else there, and he's like, "Is someone else getting out of the car?" I'm like, "No." And then my actor friend Brian is like, "Dan, this is my dentist friend. This is the guy who made my teeth." And there's the bit of a learning curve to dealing with a 21-year-old, but he accepted it, and we started talking about the other stuff that he wanted, and I showed him pictures of things that I had done. One of them was this dead zombie lady with long blonde hair that I was doing as a Halloween decoration just for fun. His comment to that picture was, "Oh, we have a character kind of like this in our movie, but there's this audio animatronics company building it, and it's really close to like what you did." And I'm like, "Oh, that's cool." That was the end of that. Couple weeks later, the audio animatronics company declares bankruptcy. The director calls me and says, "Hey, would you be interested in building an animatronic puppet for our movie?" I was 21. I was working full time on Cocoon for somebody else. My response, "Sure, that would be great. When is it due?" "It shoots in 2 weeks." "Okay, that would be great. I'll figure it out with my boss and get time off for the day it shoots. And I'll work nights because I'm 21 and I'll just make it happen." And I just took it all on and went for it. And I was completely exhausted by the end of 2 weeks.
I'm sure.
But I showed up on set and I got to puppeteer the character that I built, and I had my first screen credit, all because I built some teeth for a friend of mine who just asked me if I could do him a favor. And I said yes. And I just leaned into that experience and whatever came out of it. And all sorts of things happened. But if I had said no to that pair of teeth, none of that would have happened. And I wouldn't have had, screen credit and credibility at age 21. So believe in yourself and push forward. I mean, nobody's going to do it for you. Nobody's going to, don't sit by the phone and wait for someone to call you because there's a lot of other people calling them. But show what you're capable of doing. If you can dance, have a reel. If you do makeup, have photos. You can start an Instagram account that's just about you as a professional, as opposed to you as a person, that just highlights all your professional stuff so that you can send people a link to share, like, hey, here's what I'm up to. And at the same time, they can scroll back down and look at other things you've done, because they look at your portfolios and your reels as catalogs of what you can do. And they don't think of the potential a lot of times. They just want to order from the catalog. And they don't want to say, well, if they can do X, they can also do Y and Z. They just see they can do X. Because a lot of these people making the decisions are the business people a lot of time. It's like, who fills the bill for the product that we need on set right now? Not who has the potential to fill that bill. So show people diversity and show people variety and give them options to begin with, so they don't pigeonhole you in one thing. So again, the guy who offered me the advice of focus on one thing and do it well, it's like, I thought it was great at the time, and now it's just like, that was the worst advice ever. And I'm glad I saw it when I did and realized it.
Before we go, I want to ask some rapid fire questions. Favorite horror film?
Alien. It's a haunted house movie with an alien.
Jason or Michael Myers?
Ooh, I want to say Michael Myers. It's just more messy and misunderstood.
What movie and/or franchise would you love to work on?
I'd love to work on Alien again, just because that was my interest. And I got to work on Aliens. And it'd be fun to come back and like do the whole thing.
What is your favorite effect you've done?
Favorite effect? I think Darkman, which was a makeup on Liam Neeson for a movie Sam Raimi directed. Because it had to be scary and sympathetic at the same time. And I'd never done overlapping prosthetic makeups, but I said, sure, I can do that.
Yeah. Who would you like to collaborate with?
I'd love to collaborate with Sam Raimi again.
And then when you're not busy, what do you like to do for yourself?
Decorate for Halloween.
Do you go full out?
Oh yeah, we're pretty sad. Or psycho, depending on how you want to describe us. But my kids grew up thinking every house had a Halloween tree in their living room with weird ornaments and stuff on it.
Oh, that's
So
awesome. I didn't realize too,
yeah.
because I'm new here, but they have, I'm in Burbank, and they have like a map of like the houses that decorate and go full out.
Oh, really?
So yeah, and so I'm gonna go look around and at night and see all the houses. And I heard that in Tulare Lake, there's like this old house that decorates big time for the
That's
season.
great.
So
There's we lived in Sierra Madre briefly for a couple of years, and there's a whole street where everybody, there's like hundreds of pumpkins carved, and it's just you can just wander down. One house alone had over 100 of them up the driveway and all over the place. And I think it's become even bigger at this point and crazier. But we live in Lake Arrowhead, and there's literally no trick-or-treaters. So we're decorating at this point for ourselves, but we
yeah,
enjoy it.
I love it. Oh,
Yeah.
well, make sure you follow Tony at Tony Gardner on Instagram, and then check out his company at alterioninc.com. And then your daughter also has a podcast called Flesh and Blood and Bone on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Make sure to check that out.
Cool, yeah. That's through Fangoria, and they have it too. Oh, and Kira also films them.
Yes.
And we're doing a Hocus Pocus episode today, and she usually dresses up as somebody from the films that I work on. And she posts a YouTube version on YouTube, so you can watch it as well as listen to it. And then she puts in film clips and stuff like that. So I'm actually at her place right now, and she's getting dressed up as Billy Butcherson. So I'm
I love
curious
it.
to
Oh,
see
I can't wait to watch that one. That's
what
gonna
it
be
looks like.
awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on Artifacts today. I had a blast. I've learned
Oh,
so
my
much.
pleasure. It's,
And yeah.
I just want to say I think it's really cool what you're doing,
Thank
and that
you.
you're celebrating movement and art and stuff like that, and sharing people's stories, because I think it motivates other people to realize they can do it, and it doesn't matter where
Motivates
you are.
me, that's for sure. And
Yeah.
every journey is different. And I find that
Right.
there's highs and lows, and I think it's just
Yeah.
important for people to see that people who are successful in their careers have journeys, and it's challenging and rewarding and all the things. So,
Yeah, if I could add one more thing, I would want to say that as artists, whether you're a dancer or a sculptor or whatever, everything you do is personal, and your art is personal. And when you work for other people, your work for hire, And you have to remember that it's not personal to them, it's business. So you have to really be aware of, if you want to feel satisfied, sometimes you have to do something for you, because what you're doing for other people might not give you that satisfaction, but it's still an extension of you, and you should still enjoy it and get everything you can out of it, you know.
I love it. Well, thank you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really
Yes.
cool.
And thank you to everyone who's been listening in, and stay tuned for another episode coming soon.